Nulli is off, he's playing the slots in Vegas, but we don't want you suffering complete withdrawal symptoms. So today's Big Friday interview is him talking to the former Shadow Health Secretary and Shadow Home Secretary and, of course, Strictly Sensation. It's former Conservative MP Anne Widdecombe. She's just written her autobiography and she was one of only a few female MPs when she entered Parliament. Stephen asked her what that was like.
Frankly, I never noticed it from that point of view. I never regarded myself as a woman MP. I thought I was an MP who happened to be a woman, but I wasn't some sort of special species called a woman MP. I didn't expect to be treated any differently, and therefore I wasn't. But if you go in there looking for grievance, looking for insult, looking for discrimination, believe me, you'll find it. And I always demonstrate this by referring to what happened after all the Blair babes got in. You may remember 101 of them came in. And one of them came up to me in a corridor about 6 months after that election. And she said to me, "Anne, isn't it horrible how the men are so rude to us?" And I said, "Yes. And isn't it horrible how they're so rude to each other?" And she hadn't thought of that. She'd just been roughed up in the chamber. She assumed it was because she was a woman, but in fact, it was because she was quite useless.
You see, are you honestly telling me that you never had to take on sexism, had to take on male chauvinism in there?
I really didn't. And if I ever had trouble at all on the selection round in the 70s rather than in the 80s, but if I ever had trouble on the selection round, that trouble always came from women.
Really? What type of trouble did you get?
Oh, well, I remember one woman saying to me, for example, in those days, I mean, I'm only 5'1", and in those days I was weighed 6 stone 12. And she said to me, actually drawing a little triangle in the air, she said, "You look very small and frail. Are you sure you're up to it?" Well, when I went out into the anteroom, there was a man waiting to be interviewed who was certainly very short of stature. I bet she never asked him that.
Did you tell her?
What I said to her, "Of course I'm up to it. You've just heard the speech." I said something like that. I can't remember.
Where does this confidence come from?
Oh, over time. It's the same answer, I think, to the question which I quite often get, which is, well, doesn't all the press criticism hurt? And the answer is that if it all came the second day after I got into Parliament, I would have been pretty flattened by it. But you get inured by degrees. You're a backbencher. You only get a little bit of attention. You take up some fairly contentious causes, as I did. You get a bit more attention. You become a minister a bit more. You get used to it by degrees. And I think the confidence grows by degrees as well. It isn't something that you're just born exuding from the cradle, at least not in my case.
Everybody's confidence wobbles from time to time,
of course,
though,
it does.
Doesn't it? What have the really difficult personal times been for you in Parliament? What have you found tough?
I think probably the worst period of all was in 2000 when I was the Shadow Home Secretary. And I made a speech advocating a policy which had been approved properly through the usual mechanisms, advocating a speech in which I put forward advocating zero tolerance for drugs, all the way down the scale from the big importers right down to small scale possession, because drugs were accounting for 80% of all acquisitive crime and about 30% of all crime. So I thought if you can make an impact on drugs, you can make a huge impact on crime in general. No sooner had I delivered that speech than various shadow cabinet colleagues started briefing the press that they had taken drugs when they were young. I really was very, very badly let down by colleagues. It was all part of the leadership speculation that was going on at the time. And that was a very difficult period because you expect to be attacked by the opposition. That's what you expect. You don't expect to be stabbed in the back by colleagues.
And what is your style when that happens? Do you confront them? Do you hunker into a shell in yourself?
No, I mean, I think I just carried on. I think it's a question of keep calm and carry on, as they used to say in the war.
But when you're under pressure, how do you react?
Well, I think you remember who was your friend and who was not. I think you always remember that in those circumstances, and you learn from that.
So when I'm under pressure, I eat, right? And I'm very aware of it. I'm very aware that when I'm stressed, I eat. I guess that's why I'm fat.
Well, when I stress, I pray.
Do you?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I pray anyway. I mean, you don't have to be stressed to pray. But that is certainly one of my responses to stress, yes.
And have you had a deep faith for all of your life?
No, I've had a deep faith for most of my life. But there was a period of agnosticism between Oxford and coming into Parliament. There was no particular cause for it, either for becoming an agnostic or for ceasing to be an agnostic. The one was a gradual erosion of belief and the other was a gradual erosion of unbelief. And that's really the only way I can describe it.
Do you keep your faith out of politics, or do you bring it in?
You can't. You can't keep your faith out of politics, because if you have faith, it affects everything you do. And I've always been very open about my faith and very open about how it affects what I believe and what I do. And I've always made that very clear to my constituents. And people would say, oh, don't put that on your election address, you'll lose votes. But in fact, my majorities went up. Because people want to know what politicians believe in, even if they don't always agree with them, even if they don't ever agree with them.
You see, I asked you, there was a reason for my question about is it fair to mix politics with your faith? Because obviously some other politicians have been challenged about this in recent times. And I noticed in your book, it was page 400 of your book, actually, you write, today my concern, this is about David Cameron, and you write, today my concern is less that Cameron is big-headed than pig-headed. His haughty dismissal of the anguish his pursuit of gay marriage has caused to some of his most loyal supporters in the country has driven them into the arms of UKIP, and if they're not wooed back, then the only beneficiary will be Miliband.
Yeah.
Now, you see, it's interesting, isn't it? Is it for David Cameron to represent all of the people, or is it for David Cameron to represent what he might personally feel and take direction possibly from his faith?
Look at what I wrote there. I didn't say, because David Cameron believes in gay marriage, I said his haughty dismissal of the anguish it was causing, by which I was referring to his refusal to listen to people, to engage with people. And indeed, it is now reported that the sheer scale of the discontent, a majority of his MPs actually voted against that legislation, that the sheer scale of that discontent did apparently, it is reported, take him by surprise. Now, you've got to read what I wrote there. I was talking about the way he refused to engage with people over it rather than about his own beliefs.
But is it your direction that you're taking from your Bible, from your interpretation of your faith, that means you're against gay marriage and abortion?
Nope. I always say, let's take abortion first, then gay marriage. I always say, but when people ask me if I'm against abortion because I'm a Catholic, I say, no, I'm probably a Catholic because I'm against abortion. I was against abortion as an Anglican, as an agnostic, as a Catholic, because I strongly believe in the sanctity of life in the womb and that the unborn child has no voice other than the voice which Parliament actually gives it. So I've always held to that view, and faith has had nothing to do with it. But when I was engaged in the big pro-life campaigns shortly after I got into Parliament, David Alton had a private members bill. When I was engaged in those big campaigns, it brought me back into contact with Catholicism that I hadn't really encountered deeply, at any rate. I hadn't really encountered since I'd left my convent school when I was 18. And from that, things developed. So I often say, no, actually, it's the other way around. Similarly for gay marriage. I would be against gay marriage, regardless of whether I had a faith or not. And indeed, a lot of people who don't share my faith share the view on that.
Why do you think you've never got married?
It didn't happen. I've lost count of the number of times I've said this, Stephen. It just didn't happen. It was a mixture of chance and choice. It was chance because Mr. Wright didn't happen to come along. I would have been quite receptive if he had. And it was choice in as much as it was never a sufficiently big priority for me to go out and try and find this Mr. Wright who
didn't
come
along. It could have happened, because if you read your book, Colin Maltby was Mr. Wright, wasn't he?
Well, he was Mr. Wright for a while.
He's an ex-boyfriend.
He's an ex-boyfriend. He was Mr. Wright for a while. But it didn't translate into marriage. And as I say, nobody came along after that. Well, hang on. When we broke up, I didn't think this is it. That's the end. I was only in my 20s at the time. I just assumed vaguely that somebody else would come along. It didn't happen. And as I say, it wasn't a big enough priority for me to go out to try deliberately to make it happen.
Were you madly in love?
At the time in Oxford, I was in love. Yes, of course I was.
You see, I've watched interviews with you before, and you get slightly prickly when people keep asking you about
this.
Because you go on and on, all of you.
Well,
hold on. We're not going on and on. But for someone that is so... You're very outgoing. You're very confident. And when you say it didn't happen...
It didn't.
You must have put a barrier up. No, there must have been people that wanted to love you.
Stephen! I put no...
Now, don't you start getting prickly again.
I am, because you're assuming I must have put a barrier up. You have no evidence to say that at all. The fact is, it just didn't happen. That's all.
And whose fault's that? Is that your fault or whose fault's that?
There's no fault involved. It just didn't happen.
Okay, well, let me ask it a different way. Do you feel lonely because it didn't happen?
No. If I felt lonely, Stephen, I assume I would have gone out and tried to find Mr. Wright. I never did feel lonely. I now have an active preference for living on my own, a really active preference. And I do go back in the book, and I actually trace that through, because interestingly, when I left Oxford, most of my friends were going into flat shares in London. I didn't. I wanted to live on my own. And that desire has stayed with me throughout my life. I like coming back at night, shutting the door on the world and thinking, thank heavens for that. However much I may enjoy what I've been doing in the day, when I come back at night, I actually do thank heaven that there's just nothing there.
Now, I promise you'll move on in a second, but there is another question I want to ask you. Well, don't, you've been telling me this for years, you don't believe me. Now, tell me this. Do you regret not having children?
No.
You see, I don't have children, right?
Yeah.
And when I'm talking to my work colleagues or whatever, and they show me pictures of their kids, or they're going off the weekend with their kids, I am deeply envious.
No, I'm really not. And I think if I'd been that bothered about having children, I mean, if you asked me would I rather have children than not, then I would probably say yes, in the same way that if you asked me would I rather have been Prime Minister than not, I'd say oh yes. But it doesn't mean it's an active regret, and I've no active regrets about not having children. And again, I think that if I'd felt, oh dear, I really am very, very envious of all these people who've got children, I really want my own, then again, I think I would have gone out and looked for Mr. Wright. I just didn't, Stephen. And if you can't accept the words just didn't, I can't elucidate much further. I just didn't.
You see, you're laughing, right? But this is a...
Of course
this
I'm
is,
laughing.
This is a, I know, but this is a... This...
I'm laughing because it's hopeless. I mean, I've had this conversation so often and it's hopeless.
I know you have. But, okay, well, let me put it a different way then. Now that you're getting older in life, what is important to you? So a partner in life isn't. So
no.
Children isn't.
No.
So what is?
Well, my family, my wider family is important to me. My faith is important to me. Peace and quiet on Dartmoor are important to me. Keeping in good health in old age is important.
How do you do that?
Well, I walk a lot on the moor.
You see, do you know what's happening in this interview? We've got these norms in this society, and I guess it's my fault, not yours. And the norms, the parameters are, well, you know, you must want to get married, you must want to have kids, you must want to go walking with people. And actually, maybe you're doing nothing wrong. Maybe you just want to be alone, you enjoy your own company, you don't want kids, you want to walk as a loner. Maybe it's me.
I don't think it's you. I understand from a certain point of view where you're coming from, and I understand to a certain extent for this reason. I always find it very difficult to understand people who are married and have quite deliberately chosen not to have children. I find that difficult to understand, but nevertheless...
Why?
But nevertheless, even though I do find it difficult to understand that being married, they don't want children, I can still respect the fact that that is what they think and that it's no good people like me saying, oh, but you must think differently. They obviously don't. And so if you translate that to where you're now coming from, you think, oh, surely I think differently. But I don't. It's not just you. I think most people who are very, very convinced about something or intense about something find it difficult to understand when other people just don't react that way at all.
I'm looking through your book here. You're described as a Westminster oddball who was so unaccountably popular in the rest of the country. Anne Whittingham, are you an oddball?
Well, that's how people thought of me at Westminster. There's no doubt about that.
But how do you view yourself?
Well, naturally, I think it's the rest of the world that's mad.
Do you think you're eccentric?
No, I don't think so. But other people tell me I am, so presumably I am.
You are eccentric.
I am, right. But okay, if you say so.
But in a nice way. I like you. I genuinely do like you. And I'll tell you what I like about you. I don't think it's fake insofar as... You don't give a damn what other people think, do you?
Oh, well, that's simply being true to one's beliefs, and that should not be regarded as eccentric. That there was a time when that would have been regarded as the norm, that doubt would have been regarded as the oddity, and that you really should know what you stand for. And after all, I dare say there were people who thought that Wilberforce was eccentric. You know, you have people throughout time who've don't care what other people say, stick to their own course. Florence Nightingale, Elizabeth Fry, all those people stuck to a course that everybody else thought was either mad or bad.
And yet, and I've been nice to you so far, right?
Oh, now you're going to be horrible, right?
And yet, you go into Strictly. Now, why do people go into Strictly? They go into Strictly either for the money, so either you like the money or the fame. And to let people know who you really are. So then you do give a damn what people think.
Have you ever considered that a very good reason for doing Strictly is that it is undiluted fun and frivolity? Now, I had spent 23 years, Stephen, in which every single thing I did, whether it was the way I handled a piece of casework, to the way I voted in Parliament, to the policies that I espoused as a minister, in which every single thing I did could affect other people for good or for ill. On Strictly, the only thing I could affect for any ill at all was Anton Chin's. And other than that, there was no responsibility. If I fell down in a heap, that didn't affect anybody else.
I'm not buying this, and I'll tell you why.
Well, I don't care whether you buy
it. I know you don't care. I know you don't care, Mrs. But listen, you could have gone ballroom dancing in your local village. You could have gone privately, but you put yourself in front of millions of people. Now tell me why.
That's not about
having fun.
I've told you why.
That's about the fame or the money or to prove to people what your personality actually is. Is that a bit of it?
I did it. No, there was no question of proving to people what my personality is. I did it for the fun of it. I wanted to do it. I enjoyed doing it. They had asked me every year from 2004 until 2009. And every year, in a very straight-laced fashion, I said, no, I can't do that while I'm an MP. Too much time, too much loss of dignity. But the instant I was no longer an MP, I agreed to do it.
Why?
Now, if it was for the reasons that you've suggested, I could have done it any time between 2004 and 2009.
Loss of dignity?
Big time. Well, I don't think you do that as an MP. I don't think your constituents expect it. I wouldn't do it. But once I alone appear to have understood that when I retired from Westminster, that day and that hour, I was no longer an MP. I wasn't some sort of honorary MP. I just wasn't an MP. And from that day and hour onwards, I had no obligation to think as one, act as one, take decisions as one. And that is what I did. And Strictly was a tremendous, tremendous kickstart to my retirement, I can tell you. It was wonderful.
Does it pay well?
It certainly does pay well. Everybody knows that.
How well?
Extremely well.
How much?
Mind your own business. How much do you earn? How much do you earn? What's your salary?
Mind your own business.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Is money important to you? Do you like money?
I like not to worry about it. I'm not concerned about amassing huge amounts. And, for example, Big Brother asked me to go on. They offered me twice.
Oh, go on.
No, hang on. They
go
offered,
on.
Let me finish. They offered me twice as much as Strictly, and I wouldn't do it for five times as much or even 10 times as
never?
Much because I disapprove of it. No, never.
Why?
Promise, I disapprove of it. Because it's nothing except voyeurism. There's no real point or purpose to it.
You would win, you know. You would win it. You would win. The public would love you. You would win it.
No, thank you.
You'd probably get, what would you get? They'd probably give you 100, 150 grand.
They were offering more than that, and I said no.
You know, you can't ask a lady how old she is, but you're getting on.
I'm 66.
Right. So, like, 66 terrifies me.
Why?
Because I'm...
How old are you?
I'm 40, and I think I'm nearly dead, right? And the thought of being sick, I think I'll die in my 50s, and 66 is just, I just think it's dead.
Oh, so, you poor old man.
So are you kind of chasing time?
No, not at all. I think the third age.
Are you aware
age
of your mortality?
No, I think the third age now is very different. I can remember my granny at my age. I can remember my mother at my age. And the approach to life was completely different then. Now, I think when you're 66, it's like what it once was when you were 50. Everybody's aware of their own mortality. And as much as soon as something goes wrong, you think, oh, dear, you know, you're not going to last forever. You get creaks and aches that you never got before. And you think, oh, what's all this about? But what I like now, I mean, as I say, my faith is important to me. My family is important to me. Peace and quiet's important to me. Very important to me.
So we're nearly done, right?
Oh, right.
What do you still want to do in life? What are your dreams? You must have them.
Well, I'm still writing. And I've just finished a detective novel. And I'm taking the unusual step, for me at any rate, of putting that through Amazon, through ebooks. And seeing what happens. I wouldn't do that with one of my ordinary novels, but I thought I'd have a go with a detective novel, and it is quite exciting, but I don't know whether it's going to work or not, Stephen. You know, it's just a new venture for me.
Thank you so much. I always enjoy talking to you. I really do. And
I enjoy the cut and thrust.
And the autobiography, Strictly Anne, is out now. Thank you very much, Anne. Lovely to talk to you.
Thanks.